Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. You know, at MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com, brought to you today on the iPhone, Android, Palm, and BlackBerry by the Stitcher app for mobile devices. Mr. Media is also sponsored by ThePartyAuthority.us. Planning a wedding, mitzvah, or corporate event? For any and all occasions, call the Party Authority nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJs. That's 1-800-342-5357, where one call does it all. So where was I before the commercial? Oh, yeah. Mr. Media is recorded live from the new media capital of the world and hometown of Florida Governor and Republican Party pariah, Charlie Crist, St. Petersburg, Florida. Okay, here's the opening line of a conversation that would get me divorced. Honey, I'm going to spend the next 17 months researching and reporting about President Obama's first year in office. Oh, and I'm going to keep my full-time job at the magazine and keep showing up as a talking head on TV, too. Of course, I'm not Jonathan Alter, national affairs columnist at Newsweek, frequent political analyst on MSNBC, and author of a fascinating new behind-the-scenes book, The Promise, President Obama, Year One. If your only previous exposure to Alter has been in small doses via his appearances on MSNBC and Meet the Press, you'll be impressed at how well his approach to politics and journalism holds up over the course of an entire book. There is straight reporting, of course, but also the occasional zinger or observation that captures the point in a sharp-edged arrow, sentence. And it isn't a mere bow to Barack Obama in this book as the promised one. Alter identifies mistakes in strategy, errors in judgment, and more than a few of the new president's character flaws. Now, as a teen, I found Joe McGinnis's The Selling of the President, 1968, oddly compelling. It, in turn, propelled me to read histories of most 20th century presidents, except for you, Woodrow Wilson. So for me, The Promise is like a Charleston chew. Its flavor lasts all day and leaves you wanting more. Now, Alter is joining us on Mr. Media today to promote his appearance on Tuesday, May 25th, at Forum Truth in Sarasota, Florida. His talk starts at 7:30 p.m., and the cost of admission includes a copy of his book, The Promise. You can make reservations online at www.forumtruth.org or by phone 941-349-8350. And Jonathan, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks so much, Bob. I love that first line. I'm going to tell my wife tonight. She's going to go, "You got it, baby."
That's what I wanted to start with, frankly, Jonathan. I mean, seriously, how did your wife not divorce you between November 08 and March 2010 when you finally turned this in?
You know, it's a great question. She did say at the end of the process, that was hard. It was hard on me, and it was hard on all of us. Our youngest child, Molly, who's 16, is still living at home. Our two older kids are in college, but... You know, I was in what they called the salt mine an awful lot of the time when I was around, and then there was a lot of time when I was in Washington. So it was a little rough, but we have a great marriage, and it never really got serious. But she did an awful lot more around the house. So I have, now that the book is done, I've got a lot of catching up to do because she's got a lot of favors in the bank.
and is she able? I mean, if I brought my car by, could she overhaul my transmission now herself?
Well, you know, she has a really busy job, too. She is the senior supervising producer for the Colbert Report.
Really?
And so... She, has a very, very high-stress job because her job is to book the guests on that show, and they account for often more than a third of the show. And Stephen Colbert rightly has very high standards for the kinds of guests they get. So she's under a lot of stress, too. So maybe the real hero of the story is Molly, the 16-year-old who put up with this.
Well, and so you have a new book out this week. Can she, you know, can she put in a good word for you to get on Colbert?
You know, I'm going on Colbert on the 7th of June, and it'll be my fourth appearance on that show. And when last year Stephen Colbert guest-edited an issue of Newsweek, it was, you know, picture was on the cover. It was a pretty funny deal, and he's having his
head shaved.
Yes, and he had a little bug line where it says, you know, Jonathan Alter is so-and-so. And the week that he was editing the magazine, under my column it said, Jonathan Alter has appeared on the Colbert Report 3 times. He was good twice. To figure out which time I bombed when I was on the show.
I remember that. That was a great line. He was writing kind of in the columns and all over the place.
He was writing on the whole thing. He's a great guy, and you know, it's right now we both have very fulfilling, tough but fulfilling jobs, and we don't go out a lot and try to spend time with Molly in her last 3 years before she goes to college. So it's real exciting. It's real TMZ stuff in the Alter house. We work and then we have dinner and then we work a little more and then we go to bed.
Well, but okay, when you go to bed, the shop talk must be magnificent compared to most households.
We do a lot of shop talk. Yeah. Yeah. It's a little, you know, limited, I guess you could say. Although the Colbert Report has such the world is really it's beat. You know, she can book guests on all kinds of different subjects. So in that sense, it's a very far-flung set of subjects that we talk about. But a lot of it revolves around who should she get for the show and who should I try to interview for the book? So it's kind of variations on a theme.
It would be kind of interesting. And I'll be honest, I had no idea when I brought up your wife that's what she did. I had, for all I knew, she stayed at home and took care of the kids. So that is amazing. I had no idea. You know, if I was an attorney, I should know the answers to the questions before I come in. But I can say, well, I'm a journalist and a radio host, so I don't have to know the answer to every question. And that was a good one.
It's funny, Bob, you mentioned that, and that gives me a segue into a scene in the book that I haven't discussed publicly before, but I found to be one of the most interesting parts. And it's not, you know, a sexy part like the Carla Bruni thing, but the McChrystal report of the Pentagon wanted to, you know, they did. They assigned General McChrystal to deliver this report, and the report kind of boxed in the White House and the president. And I have a lot in the book about how he dressed down the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and they had a very tense confrontation, which we can talk about. But before that point, Joe Biden is upset about the signing of the McChrystal report, and in a meeting with the president and some others, he says, it reminds me of a story when I first came to the Senate, and I went to Chairman McClellan, who was from Arkansas, and I was making a request of him. I wanted a favor from him of something, and he wasn't inclined to give it to me, and I said, well, I'll write you a letter outlining it. And then Biden starts to imitate McClellan. He says, a piece of advice for you. Never send a man a letter he doesn't want to receive. Never send something where you don't know the answer. And it's kind of like that point you just made about lawyers. And so he saw the McChrystal report as a letter from the military that they didn't want to receive in the White House.
Jeez. I can't, not only do I have you telling me the Colbert information, but I've now got you doing Joe Biden imitating other people. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's Joe Biden imitating me, imitating Joe Biden, imitating John McClellan, who goes back to the McCarthy era. He was in the Senate from the 50s through the 70s.
Rich Little is somewhere listening to this podcast going, I got to learn how to do McClellan. Like,
he bombed at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Well, look, let's talk about this. Now, in your previous book, which was the defining moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, you had, I think, the benefit of time. I mean, FDR and everyone who worked with him were long gone, and you could do your reporting and research more casually. But for The Promise, you were literally operating on internet time. How different were the two projects for you as a writer?
You know, I have to say that The Promise was a lot harder. With history, they're all dead, you know, if the history goes back far enough. And I interviewed a few people who remember the Roosevelt inauguration in 1933 or the Democratic Convention of 1932, but they were very old and they've since died. The documents weren't going anyplace. You know, if I didn't get the documents on a Tuesday, I could get them on a Wednesday. And it was all kind of more manageable and leisurely. And also, I spent from 2002 to late 2005 writing that book. Now, it's true that I got cancer in the middle of that, so it took a little bit longer. But it was at a much more leisurely pace than this book. But to go to your question, it's a trade-off. So I was trying to report history on the fly and get to people who had been taken part in important events not often right when the events were taking place, but usually a few weeks or a couple of months later. And so the memories were still really fresh. And so the advantage that I had over the oral histories and documents that I used for the Roosevelt book was that I had better reason to believe that the quotes were from the president were accurate and that the stories were accurate. So you'd think that journalism would be less reliable than history, but in some ways I think it's more reliable, because the problem with the oral histories and the memoirs that historians depend on is that they're written many years after the fact, and memories play tricks on people, and the anecdotes that they have been told so often they have hair growing on them. You know, and so and they're sculpted and, you know, perfected, and they at a certain point become apocryphal. I'm not vouching for the 100% accuracy of everything in the book, because no history works that way. I mean, there are no mistakes that I know of right now, but it's very, very hard. That's why I call it only the second draft of history. There will be many more drafts to come. But what I wanted was to give historians some raw material that they could use, and then when the documents do come out, they can measure them against this early account of the early part of Obama's presidency, and they can see whether it stacks up. Now, I didn't do – so they, you know, let's say the documents on the decision, you know, the minutes – of the decision to send more troops to Afghanistan, when the minutes come out years from now, it'll be very interesting to see how they stack up against some of the contemporaneous notes that were described to me by participants in the meetings. If this is getting too kind of heavy-duty historian talk, let me know. But
no, it's good.
You know, there will be some advantages when certain things are declassified a long time from now. The main advantage that I had on the Roosevelt book was one's perspective is deepened by time, and I could see him more fully in the context of his time. And since a lot of things haven't happened yet. The beginning of the book project, nothing had happened. It was like writing on a, you know, in disappearing ink. But, you know, a few years from now, we'll be able to see whether something's happened. But, whether things have happened that put everything in a different light. But just to give you a short example before I stop rambling on this question, the book was done on April 1st, and if it had been a week later, I would not have gotten the healthcare signing into the book. And the whole tone of the book and the introduction and the themes would have been draped in failure, and instead it's, you know, looks like success. But even that is tentative, because if 5 years from now the consensus is that healthcare reform was a failure, then the light that I casted in it in 2010 will be off. So it's all of these are kind of fascinating, what are sometimes called historiographical questions, mm-hmm. that can never be resolved. But I'd say that both projects, both Roosevelt and Obama, were some blending of history and journalism, which have been my two main interests.
And I brought up the Roosevelt book because I'm wondering, since you did both of these and spent a lot of time, you know, studying Roosevelt and then have spent a lot of time up close and personal with Obama and his group, you know, when he first took office, there was a lot of talk about comparisons between the two. Do you see it, or was that overblown?
Well, I do see it on some level. You know, Roosevelt went over to Oliver Wendell Holmes's house right after the inauguration in 1933, and when he left, Holmes said, second class intellect, first class temperament. And so right. I'm very interested in this question of temperament. Obama has a first class intellect. He's actually quite a bit smarter than Franklin Roosevelt, just in an IQ sense. But we don't really know yet whether he has a first class temperament. It seemed he has what I describe as a Zen temperament, and I have a whole chapter on it, and it has some great advantages. It was clearly superior to John McCain's temperament. That calm, cool, collected approach was appealing to the American people in 2009, but I don't think that I don't think it's clear yet whether he really has a Rooseveltian connection to the American people. And when Roosevelt died and his funeral procession was moving up Constitution Avenue, a man fell to his knees in grief, and the man next to him helped him to his feet and said to the grieving man, "Did you know the president?" And the first man said, "No, but he knew me." And even though Roosevelt was a patrician, aristocrat, people sensed that he really connected to their problems and what they were going through. And Obama is trying to make that connection, but he hasn't made it yet. And he doesn't have that effervescent temperament that Roosevelt had, that it's like meeting him was described as being like opening your first bottle of champagne. So we don't quite know how Obama's temperament will wear over time. I think there's some favorable signs that it's a temperament that agrees with the American people. His personal popularity stayed high, even as his program has become less popular. And in terms of what they did, both men rejected the pleas of liberals to nationalize the banks, and they went for more conservative bank rescue programs. And the New Dealers got very upset that Roosevelt wasn't nationalizing the banks in the same way the Paul Krugmans of the world got upset with Obama. And the New Dealers in 1935 were very upset that Roosevelt's Social Security bill was so tame, and it excluded about 60% of senior citizens. It was a racist bill that was written to discriminate against blacks and had a lot of other things wrong with it. But Roosevelt figured we got to start somewhere. We got to get something through, and then we can fiddle with it and fix it in the years ahead, as indeed they did. And of course, we all know that liberals were, for a time, very upset with Obama's healthcare plan for not including a public option. But both were major victories, and Obama is now in the company of Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson as a figure of great domestic achievement, and not just for the health care bill, but he had a string of other legislative victories in 2009 that did not get very much attention but were significant. Just to give you one quick example, Roosevelt in 1933 founded the Civilian Conservation Corps. It sent 250,000 young people at first into the forests, planting trees, clearing trails, eventually millions, but at first 250,000. Tremendous amount of publicity. Obama added 250,000 young people to the AmeriCorps program, signed the bill with Ted Kennedy and Bill Clinton. Very little publicity. So some of it is just kind of what we're interested or not interested in these days, and some of it is that it's a lot harder politically to get credit for preventing a recession, which is what Obama did, than it is for beginning to get us out of a depression, which is what Franklin Roosevelt did in much more dire times.
Jonathan, what kind of access did you have to the president, all the president's men and women, of course?
I interviewed the president and the vice president and what are called the Big Four, Rahm Emanuel, Valerie Jarrett, David Axelrod, and Pete Rouse, as well as a number of other people who are quoted in the book, and then a large number of people who, for a variety of reasons, are not quoted and spoke only on background or told me things, not for attribution basis. But I felt like the officials were very, very busy, and they canceled a lot of interviews with me. But I did feel that, generally speaking, I had very good access, and with a few exceptions, was able to talk to the people that I needed to.
Now, I was thinking about this today. I remember how surprised I was when Bob Woodward produced a number of books about the George W. Bush's administration while Bush was in office, and seemingly he was a fly on the wall. And some of that material, as I recall, was highly embarrassing to the administration. So I wondered, why would the Obama administration give you somewhat similar access while things were happening?
Well, you know, I think that, as one official told me, look, we're sort of torn between, you know, recognizing that we could get ourselves in trouble or something could come out that's, you know, not totally flattering, but we also have a sense of history, and they want to, you know, they're there, they're working their butts off, you know, 7 days a week often to be part of history, and they part of them kind of likes it when that somebody's there to record it for history. Some of them don't care that much. I don't think Rahm Emanuel cares very much about books. I mean, he gave me some time because mostly because I've known him for more than 20 years. And he's a tremendously colorful character who I devote a whole chapter to called Rambo.
Right.
After that movie with Sylvester Stallone. And some people were very skittish for the reasons you describe, and I think if there hadn't been some of these long-standing relationships, I've known David Axelrod for 26 years, and so I think there were a number of people who, when I wanted to talk to them, they checked with Ax, and Axelrod said, yeah, it's, you know, go ahead, be careful, whatever they would say in that sort of situation, and So they cooperate some, and I think it's good that they do, because they claim to want a transparent administration, and being open to book writers should be part of that deal, even if they're not happy with everything that's in it.
Well, the thing that surprised me is, now I understood with the Bush administration letting Woodward come in and do his thing, because it didn't seem like anybody there read books, but I mean, Obama, not only reads books, but he writes books, so I figured that was a little weird.
yeah, well, I think he's saving his best material for his own books, I would imagine. and his books will, because he is such a good writer, his books will be the dominant books, you know, coming out of this period, although that's obviously one perspective, and maybe those books won't be as good. His second book wasn't as good as his first one. The Audacity of Hope wasn't as good as Dreams from My Father. It was good, but it wasn't as good. And I would imagine that his, well, maybe he can break the string of boring presidential memoirs, going back to Ulysses S. Grant, who had some hope, some help from Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens. That was the last good presidential memoir. And so it'll be interesting to see whether Obama manages to break that streak and get some of that Grant magic. But we won't know for several years.
Well, I have a lot more questions I'd like to ask, but I know we're going to run out of time in a few minutes. I want to ask you, before you have to go, about the mood at Newsweek, that other job of yours. It's been a very rough year, I think, since the makeover of the look and the content, and then the announcement a few weeks ago that the magazine was on the market. How are things going over there?
Well, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to find a buyer, and there's a lot of interest. And honestly, I think the condition of the magazine was kind of misrepresented in the press. And I have every reason to believe that, you know, we're going to be around. I could be wrong, but I'm hopeful. And obviously, it's a hard time at the magazine right now.
Hmm. Well, there's a very good piece in the latest issue, the May 24th and 31st double issue. It's by this guy named Alter. It's apparently an excerpt from his new book, The Promise. I can recommend that to people if they're looking for something to read, you know, on the train. Or
The thing we excerpted was about what I mentioned, you know, the president being boxed in. And as he told me, I asked him, were you jammed by the Pentagon? And he said, quote, "I neither confirm nor deny being jammed by the Pentagon." I tell the story that's in the excerpt and then at greater length in the book of, you know, this kind of high drama behind the scenes last fall. And then I think there was high drama on healthcare as well, where he essentially did it alone over the objections of the vice president. Rahm Emanuel told me I begged him not to do this in his first year. David Axelrod opposed it. The Council of Economic Advisors opposed it. So there were these hidden dramas that we didn't know about in 2009. I really wanted to tell people, what's it like when they close that door of the Oval Office, they close the door of the Situation Room? What's happening inside? And we all know, you know, what he's like when the cameras are on. I wanted to describe what he's like when the cameras are off.
Well, last question. Will there be a year two at the risk of your marriage?
No, because of it's not because of my marriage, but no, it's too early for the sequel. I won't rule in or out, you know, writing another book about Obama, but it won't be year two.
All right. So Jonathan Alter will neither confirm nor deny. Hey, folks, listen. You can order The Promise, President Obama, Year One by Jonathan Alter in great bookstores everywhere or online at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And don't miss Jonathan Alter's live appearance on Tuesday, May 25th. That's at Forum Truth in Sarasota, Florida. His talk starts at 7:30 p.m., and the cost of admission includes a copy of his book, The Promise. You can make reservations online at forumtruth.org. Or by phone 941-349-8350. Jonathan, it was a lot of fun to talk to you. I'd love to have you come back and talk about the book some more or anything you like. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
I would love to do it. I feel like maybe I was a little too windy and we just scratched the surface of some of the fun things that are in the book, but I'm happy to come back and talk anytime.
We'll take you up on that. And thank you so much. Good luck with the book this week.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. And for more original interviews with America's top journalists, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. It's mrmedia.com. And please take advantage of this great offer for Mr. Media Radio listeners. You can go to audiblepodcast.com/mrmedia to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/mrmedia for your free audiobook. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, It's twitter.com/Andelman or on Facebook, search Mr. Media Interviews. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate it when you give a piece of your day. Come spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.